Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode of the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show. And today I am joined by Zoe Dronfield. Now, Zoe's a very high profile case. Some of you may or may not have heard about her case. But I'm going to let Zoe introduce herself and let her share a little bit of background. Welcome, Zoe.
Hi. Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me. I'm a victim survivor of domestic abuse and stalking, although the stalking part of it hasn't been put down on record, but, you know, I'll get into that. This happened in 2014. And since then, I've been now working in the sector, supporting and advocating for other victim survivors to make changes in the law. And I've written a book about my story. So everything's there. I'll try and condense it as much as I can for your show here, Kate. But as you know, it's very difficult to kind of condense something down into an hour's conversation. So I can give you the highlights of it. But the book's called Mind Over Manipulators. And the reason I chose that title was because I think as survivors of domestic abuse, we're kind of there's a stigma that we're these weak women cowering in the corner. And that's always the picture that gets depicted. And actually, that's not true. I think that we're often very, very strong people. And we end up with very manipulative people that we think we can change or we can help them. And actually, it ends up with our demise in some ways. So back in 2014, I was almost murdered by an ex-partner. It was a very brutal attack. It lasted over 8 hours. I was tortured, held at knife point. And the description of some of these injuries are quite graphic. So just a trigger warning there. I was stabbed. I was stamped on. I was, he literally was trying to kill me. But the start of that relationship clearly wasn't like that. They don't turn up with three heads. They don't walk into our lives and there's, we know they're an abuser. They actually start with the whole grooming process where they are love bombing us. So the beginning of that relationship was, you know, was a great relationship. But I was also quite vulnerable at the time. So the father of my daughter, he wasn't a great guy, very emotionally abusive. And I had ended that relationship and I was managing him from afar. I'd closed a business and moved back home with my father. And so I was getting my life back on track after that relationship, but I was having to manage him. He was quite controlling around my daughter who was, you know, when we split, she was 2 years old. So it was a lot. When I met Jason Smith, who was the perpetrator who almost killed me, I had been single for a while. I was a professional working in technology, working in criminal screening, believe it or not. And my father, I was living with my father at the time, and he would support me with the children. So there's a 5-year age difference between them. So she was two and Cameron was like 6, 7. And one morning he got up and he was, no, sorry, let me rewind there. I'd started, I'd used Facebook for marketing for a business that I used to have. And Jason Smith happened to be on my friends list. So that's how we started talking. He was selling a car. I'd commented, because I was looking to buy a car, commented on it. And then this conversation just went back and forth. Now I was single, he was single. And so that conversation, you know, continued. And kind of ended up with us meeting for a date. So I met him for a date at my local pub, and we just hit it off. You know, we just were talking. And I mean, to be honest with you, if I look back now, I feel like I was doing a lot of the talking and probably giving a lot of my information away, which isn't unheard of when you end up meeting a someone who's abusive. They're very clever at getting information out of you. The end of that day, you know, I was on cloud nine. It was all great, and he dropped me home in a taxi, so he knew where I lived at that point. Then the next day, I told him that I worked from home, and I got a text from him saying, "Oh, look out your window. I've got a surprise for you." So I looked out the window. He was outside. So of course, from day one, he was crossing boundaries. I felt uncomfortable with that. But then what we do is we actually romanticize those things. So I went outside, spoke to him, and I come back in, and my dad said to me, "Oh, he's keen," you know, and we kind of laughed it off. But I did feel uneasy about it. I remember feeling like that. Yeah, so the relationship continued, and then one morning my father got up, and he was taking the children to school, and I was had a meeting that I had to go to, and my dad says, "Oh, you know, I've got my legs, I can't feel my legs, I've got pins and needles." I was like, "Dad, I've got to go, you know, I've got this meeting." So anyway, I left, but within 24 hours my dad was on a tracheotomy. He'd got something called Guillain-Barré, and you know, my uncle had ended up taking the children to school, and my dad was in hospital. That was Jason's into my life, because actually then I became vulnerable. I had, you know, I'm a single mom, professional, working, no help with the kids. And I'd been dating him for a couple of months at this point. He was like, "Look, I can help you. I can step up. I can help take the kids to school." And he had a daughter at the time. So, you know, when I was with Jason, mine were like three, and I don't know, seven, three, seven, eight. And his daughter was six, so she's in between the ages. So it was, you know, we had a relationship. I'd met his daughter, and all my friends were saying, "Oh my God, how would you deal with life without him? He's like your savior. This is amazing. It's like it's been sent to you." So we, you know, the relationship progressed, and it was fine. We'd been on holidays, but things started to change. You know, at the beginning, he was buying me lots of gifts. He was being very attentive. He was making me dinner. I would get back, and dinner would be made, and he would have picked up the kids, and everything was great. But as time went on, this was gradually unraveling. So, you know, he then became quite aloof. He then became quite, you know, emotionally not there, void. Then he started drinking in the day, and this whole behavior just unraveled to the point where I was like, "Look, I can't have this around the children." So, you know, he had.
Did you find that when what he norm what he originally was only too happy to support and help with suddenly became an inconvenience to him?
Absolutely, that it was, you know, the things that he used to engineer himself into my family life were the very things that then became a problem, which then obviously caused me a problem because I was a single mom. So I had to then find support. Now he thought that he'd been able to engineer it so it was it was disrupting my life, don't get me wrong, but you know, I found a childminder. So but this is wherever I found a solution, he then found another way to kind of break something else down. And it's this constant push me, pull me. So you know, when the unraveling started and I asked him to leave, we sat down and had a conversation about it, and he seemed to accept that. You know, we had a sensible conversation. I said, "Look, you know, I just feel like you need to sort yourself out. I don't really want your behaviors around my children. If you could go and spend some time with your parents, go and stay there, and you know, and we'll continue that way." Anyway, it was as if a switch had been flipped at that point, because we had the conversation. That was fine. He left. But then that was when the calling started every day. So then he was calling me. He was tracking where I was. He would know where I was. He would then want to know where I was, who I was with, how I was spending my time. I was then trying to spend some time with friends. He would then, orchestrate things for us. It was just, it was very difficult for me to conduct my life with him being so demanding on my time.
And how far into the relationship was that? How long were you together before you had that conversation?
I mean, it was probably about 10, 11 months in, not 9, 10, 11 months in. I can't really remember it fully, but the relationship, I'd invested time in the relationship, put it that way. So, I wanted to help him. And, I didn't, it wasn't a case of, because people will say, why didn't you just leave? Well, domestic abuse doesn't just happen as a, it doesn't, they don't turn up with three heads to start off with. And then it doesn't just happen overnight. It's a gradual drip, drip, drip. And I talk about this in my book. I say it's like if you put a frog in cold water and turn up the heat, a frog will boil to death, and that's domestic abuse. Because if you just dropped a frog in boiling water, it would jump out. Whereas it is a gradual thing that happens over time. So you don't recognize what's happening because you are changing your own behaviors to accommodate the abuse that you're receiving.
Plus, as
And
well, that's what the brain does naturally is it looks for reasons and excuses for somebody's behavior, because if there's a reason for it, there's a solution to it, and the brain naturally starts seeking out those solutions to the problem, because actually they were wonderful in the beginning. So why would I want to give that up? Because that person must be somewhere. They were there in the beginning. So if I can just find and get back that person, everything will be great again.
Exactly that. And I'm condensing this really down quite a lot, but I mean, then the calls and everything started. Then, I asked him to stop calling me. I said, look, I need some space. This is too much. This is when he changed. This is when he became aggressive. The messages were quite mixed. One minute it was I love you. The next minute it was like, if you don't open the door, I'm coming through the door. I'm coming home, Zoe. You need to let me in. I want, I'm coming back. I was like, you're not coming back. And at this point I called the police and told them, look, he's calling me hundreds of times a day. I can't conduct my life. I'm a mother. I've got kids at school. I can't turn my phone off. And that was their advice, which is really bad advice, actually. Because when I did turn my phone off or I didn't answer the calls, he then started to turn up at the house. So then, he was turning up at the house, turning up drunk. So then I called the police another time where he'd left voicemails on my phone saying that he was going to kill himself. Or pretending to kill himself. He didn't actually say I'm going to kill myself, but he was like, I'm going now. And that I now know is a precursor to homicide. And if you're willing to kill yourself, you're willing to take someone else with you. That should have been a huge red flag that the police picked up on, which they didn't. And so this continued until one Saturday afternoon. I came back through my front door with my daughter. I've been shopping, and we walked through the front door, and I walked into my kitchen, and I looked in the garden. I saw him standing there. Well, it startled me because my garden's locked. You can't get in my garden, so I was shocked that he was in there. And because of the way I acted, he then ran round to the side of the house and started kicking the door. So at that point, I started ringing 999, and I said, "Look, he's here again. I'm here with my daughter. He's kicking the door. He's coming through the door." And I could hear like glass cracking and smashing. It was a whole UPVC door, and he's a big guy, he's 6 foot 15 stone. Anyway, he got through the door, ran up the stairs. I just looked at him and was like, "Oh my God," because I was there with Sophia. Sophia was 4 then, and I was like, "What are you doing?" He fell to his knees, started crying. I was like, "You need to run. The police are on the way." And I think in his deluded mind, he thought I was trying to help him or save him at that point. So he said, "I've got to go. Shall I go?" "Yeah, go." So he ran off. And even at this point, Kate, I never thought he would ever actually physically hurt me. It was never, I wasn't fearful of him. But that, because I wasn't fearful of him, when the police do the dash risk assessment, It's like, that doesn't mean I'm not at risk because I'm not fearful. That just means I'm not fearful. They have more information about how these behaviors play out. So they should understand that risk level more than I do. Obviously, I've got more understanding of that now because I've spent a decade working in this kind of sector and understanding how these perpetrators work. So anyway, the police turned up. They ran. I said, "Look, he's gone that way." They chased up the road, caught, picked him up, and he was taken in for criminal damage. So again, for me, this is a problem because it's not attributed to domestic abuse. It's labeled as criminal damage, which isn't give, you know. So then the pattern and the behavior of domestic abuse is being missed, you know, because the calls, the escalation in calls, the turning up, then the turning
So
up.
many stalking offences there.
Absolutely. And that's not even hararassment was even considered. So harassment charges were not considered, stalking charges not considered. Then he gets done for smashing the door. That's criminal damage. So this is all a problem in the way that the police actually handle cases. So then, you know, he gets picked up. The police officer's advice to me was, you don't have to press charges. What do you mean you don't have to press charges? Like I said, I worked in criminal screening. I knew the importance of getting this on their file. I was like, well, no, I want to press charges. And actually, I need to claim on my insurance. He smashed my entire door, you know, so I need to claim on my insurance and he needs to be charged. And I hopefully he'll realize the gravity of what he's done. Now, I didn't know that that's, you know, obviously going to escalate things because that's how perpetrators work. But for me, that was important. But what the police did in their infinite wisdom was then released him on bail. So, of course, he just then turned back up, continued his stalking behaviors, and I just felt like a sitting duck. And it was at that point I just thought, I'm not getting any help from the police. I have to now put matters in my own hands. I'm going to go and speak to him. I'm going to meet him. So I took a call from him. And he shouldn't have been talking to me at this time. That was his part of his bail conditions. His bail conditions, not mine, his. And so he was calling me. I took a call and we met for dinner. And I was telling him, look, I want to explain to you what this is doing to me. Please stop. You know, where what is happening to you? Why are you behaving in this way? It was so like not normal to me for somebody to unravel like this. You'd want to help them, you know, and it's when people hear the story, they think, well, why didn't at that point you just like not see him again? Well, I'd spent a year with this guy. We'd been on two holidays within that time. I'd spent time with his daughter. He'd spent time with my kids. He took my kids to and from hospital. He, you know, he was very involved in my life. So it's not something you just switch off. That's very difficult. And especially if you don't actually understand that you're with a perpetrator of domestic abuse, you don't understand that you're in danger. You don't know this. You know, I had no understanding of this. And it wasn't until afterwards that I found out what I know now about him, which I will come to. So I went and met him. We had the dinner. I'd had a couple of glasses of wine while we were talking. And then he convinced me that, look, you know, we should go back to yours because I'd arranged to meet him in a local, people knew me and they were, you know, they kept coming up and they were interrupting us. And he was like, you know, I want to speak to you in private, Zoe. I want to show you these emails. I've got a new job. I'm sorting myself out. And so I agreed to go back to mine. And, you know, so we went back to mine and the conversation continued. And actually, I was really quite angry with him. But like I said, I still, at this point, there was no fear that he was going to hurt me. I didn't think for 1 minute he'd hurt me. The way he portrayed his behaviors was, you know, I'm just devastated. You're not talking to me, Zoe. I'm just devastated. But I was like, you're being unrealistic with my time. You expect me to talk to you when you want me to talk to you. I work full time. So anyway, after that conversation, I went to bed. It was getting late. And I said, look, I'm going to go to bed. The children were at their father's at this point. So, you know, they weren't in the house. I went to bed and I thought he will either sleep on the sofa or he'll leave. I was then woken to him asking me for money. I said no, and I was, you know, half asleep. And then I just had the thud. And then there was just, and I could feel it was he had his shoes on. And then there was thud. I went from one side of the room to the other, and I just felt his kicks raining down on me. I then remember saying, what are you doing that for? In the most normal voice, like as if I was kind of like outside of my body. And that was the attack.
Yeah.
The next thing I remember is coming round, slumped over the side of the bed. My white sheets were absolutely covered in blood, sodden with blood. He was sat the other side of the bed, chopping at his wrist with a meat cleaver, saying, "We're going together, babe." And I literally knew at that point, oof, I had an adrenaline rush. I thought, I've got to get out of here. He's going to kill me.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked down at my hands. My left hand had stab wounds. It was absolutely awful. I could feel that my head was like twice the size. It was so swollen. Yeah. I was in absolute agony, but I knew I had to get out of there. And we were in the loft at this point, so I had to make my way. I said, I'm going to go and get a glass of water. I went down the two flights of stairs, got down to the lounge, picked up the landline, pressed 999. That call never connected. But at this point, Jason then walked in the room. So I threw the phone and he just walked me back upstairs. And this is when I was pleading with my life. And I've got there's a 13 minute 999 call of him speaking to the ambulance, speaking to the 999 caller, and me saying in the background, I'm dying, please help me, please help me. He was on that call for 13 minutes. Within that time of the call, we'd ended up downstairs. I think he put a towel to my neck, which is the 999 caller had told him to do this. And then the next thing I remember is that the police coming in the door. Now, that he must have unlocked the door, but actually when they came in, he was apparently lying on the floor with his eyes rolling in his head, pretending to be unconscious, you know, so he was pretending to be a victim as well.
Yeah.
But actually I was, you know, fighting for my life at this point.
Yeah.
They then stretchered me out and I went to A&E, and unbelievably, they took us both to the same A&E and I could hear him shouting for me in the next bay.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was just even at that point, and I know they'd given me a lot of doses of painkillers at this point, but even having that, you know, not even being able to get away at that point or feel safe, just frightening. Absolutely.
I know after that, Zoe, you were faced with another problem from your your daughter's father.
Yeah.
Which we will move on to after this short commercial break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back to the show. So we closed off there with the obviously you being faced with hospital and him and you're hearing your attacker, which is absolutely horrendous. One thing I wanted to just say to obviously how Zoe has said that she was never scared of him, even though he was making all these threats and being physically aggressive and violent. That's not always the. Sometimes you can get a situation where, and I know. I see my. I've spoken to Zoe about this. My story is like a replica of Zoe's. I was fearful of mine, but I couldn't articulate why I was scared of him. I didn't think that he would follow through on it. Like you said, you didn't think that he would go as far as he did.
Yeah.
And I never believed that mine would go as far. But do I think he's capable of going as far as what Zoe's attacker did? Absolutely. Mm. I think that is what I feared, because I knew I had this underlying feeling what he was capable of. So, you know, it is very different for different victims. Sometimes you will have a fear that you actually can't articulate. And sometimes it's not what they say that actually instills that fear. Sometimes it's a tone of voice. It's a look that they give you. It's gestures that they have at the time whilst making those threats. Those have a greater impact. I think it's those things that instill that fear.
And I think that's a really important point, Kate, because actually, the fact that I was not fearful was used in the DASH assessment that the police use. And then they benchmark my risk based on whether or not I was fearful. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not at risk because I wasn't fearful. I was very much at risk.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we just talked about the attack. I'm now in hospital, you know, fighting for my life, had operations on my arms, broken bones, been stabbed, slash wounds. And I then found out that actually Jason Smith is a serial perpetrator, and he had done this before. And he had done this, 13 other women, when my story went in the paper, came forward and said that they'd been in a relationship with him and he had shown all of these stalking behaviours, you know, wouldn't let them out the house, turning up unannounced, making hundreds of calls, checking car engines to see if it was warm, to see if they'd left the house. And one of those other victims was and still is a serving police officer for West Midlands Police.
Right.
And so that made me more angry, even though I'm lying in my hospital bed and I've, you know, I've gone through something and everything. It made me so angry because I'd called the police, you know, and I asked for the help and I didn't get it.
I didn't put the dots together.
No. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we will maybe get into this later on, but I mean, just quickly, I am now suing the police with other victims for that lack of investigation, because actually he was known to police. He had been in prison before against the police officer. He did 3 months of harassment 10 years prior to my case. And in between those 10 years, there was other women as well. And so we are now suing the police for lack of investigation. And that case will have far-reaching implications for other victims if we win. We're now looking for funds to support us, because actually victims of domestic abuse don't get any justice, believe it or not, and we have to fight for justice and we have to pay for our own justice. So, you know, I'm lucky that we've got a legal team that are working for us, but we've now been told the latest thing is that we've got to have these experts in court that will give evidence on behalf of each of the victims, whether or not we could have brought the case earlier, because they're saying that we're out of time. So we've now got to pay upwards, it's like £6,300 plus VAT each expert. So, I mean, you're talking like £14,000 we've got to find to actually get these experts to read over our medical records, you know, 10 years worth of stuff. I mean, it's a lot. So we've got a GoFundMe page. I'll just find the name of it,
which is crazy. It's you know, there's no accountability for the police when they make failings. They think, a fatality has occurred because of our failings. Oh, we're sorry. That's emotional. Yeah.
Oh, and you know, the usual lyrics that, you know, we will learn from our
mistakes. Well, of course, they never learn. No.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the GoFundMe page is called Justice for Victims of Serial Domestic Abusers. So if anybody wants to help us and to donate, that would be really, really useful.
What's your time frame for gathering these funds, Zoe?
So we originally had application fees, which we had to pay to get into court. We've got like, it's a matter of weeks, honestly, Kate. It's frightening how that quickly this stuff comes. So, you know, the courts can take their own sweet time with everything until it's then time for you to go into court. And it's like, right, we need an expert in the next week. So it's crucial that we get these funds now. Yeah, we've got like, I don't know. I it's very difficult to put a timeline on it because we need it yesterday, because we're outside of a time limit already. Everything's got to be done at an expedited speed. So it's really, really crucial that we get the support that we can.
It's the same old story. It's double standard. It's one rule for one and another rule for the other all the time.
And, you know, so going back to the story, I was in hospital and then my ex-partner, the father of my daughter, came in with a bunch of flowers. That's how he got in. Now, I was in a side room. I was a vulnerable person, so I was kept in the side room. But he got in with these bunch of flowers and an envelope. And then he came up to my bed. Now, I was absolutely a bit, and you can go on Google and look at my injury picture. It's out there in the public domain. I mean, it's awful. I don't even look alive. And he came
up to the... You're unrecognizable, Zoe.
No,
unrecognizable.
And he came up and he whispered in my ear, he said, "But you've done it now, you'll never see her again."
Wow.
And honest to God, that was like my whole world just shattered under my feet. I mean, there's one thing being battered and bruised and stabbed and almost murdered and, you know, surviving that, but knowing you've survived it and you're coming through it, you know, broken bones and bruises heal. But then to be blamed. So what he did is put the envelope at the end of the bed. And it was custody papers for my daughter, who was 4 years old at the time. And, you know, my son was eight, and to separate them because they were different fathers. And, you know, I had a great relationship with Cameron's father. We just amicably split up. It was normal. You know, I actually even went to his wedding. So, they were custody papers, and he'd got interim custody for my daughter, which was frightening for me. And I literally sat bolt upright in the hospital bed and went, "Get my laptop." And I had both of my hands were bandaged. And I was like, "Get my laptop. I need to write to the judge. I need to tell them I know that this, you know, that Sophia's dad's not a great guy." I didn't know to the extent of what he'd done until we got further into the whole process. But I knew that he had previous convictions for something. I thought if I wrote to the judge, they would do background checks on that. That's not how the family court system works.
No.
You know, all of that stuff has to be brought through the court.
I mean, as bad as the criminal arena are, and they don't understand the psychology of the perpetrator at all, or the victim, the family courts are even worse.
Oh my goodness. And, I mean, they're just so archaic. It's crazy.
And what, you know, if we've got any family court professionals listening to this, it's really, really important to understand that a perpetrator wants to catch their victim off guard. They will catch them at their most vulnerable.
Absolutely.
And their whole aim when they are engaging in filing applications, not turning up for hearings, not filing paperwork, all the various different games that they play, it is to, and withholding money, which is in ongoing financial abuse, they are hoping to back their victim into a corner where they comply. They want compliance. That's what they want. And they will use vulnerabilities to gain compliance. And the children are one of the main ways that they can gain compliance, because the one thing that's most important to a victim is their children. And there was Zoe fighting for her life, and you would never, the way she responded to that paperwork is not one that the way that you would expect somebody to behave to respond if they are lying in a hospital bed fighting for their life. That was the most important thing to Zoe. So it's like it's like an adrenaline rush, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like when you hear people who manage to lift cars off children, you know, in instances, they find the strength that some this inhuman strength from somewhere, and that is just a natural response.
And I think for me, it's everything that kept coming out after the attack, you know, finding out that Jason Smith is a serial perpetrator. Then being blamed for that, the violence that I received by having my daughter temporarily removed, you know, and you know, the story goes on. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
So we're just going to break for a short commercial break, and we're going to talk more about the family court, because that was directly abuse that she was experiencing. So we'll see you in a short minute.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So the family court, Zoe, how did that go? Because I mean, obviously I have listened to other interviews of yours, so I know. Obviously, do you want to share some of that? That was pretty horrific.
Honest to God, I actually say that that was the worst part of the whole entire thing that I went through. You know, the bruises and everything heal, but actually being labelled as if you're an unfit parent is just horrific, absolutely horrific. And, you know, considering that I was the one that did everything with my children, and the fact that Sophia was removed, but my son wasn't. You know, that it just doesn't make sense. So I discharged myself from hospital. The nurses didn't want me to leave, but I was like, the court date was 2 weeks from that date where he put the envelope on my bed.
And to be honest, that was a huge failing on the family court's part. You know, they should have taken that into consideration completely.
But nobody even put two and two together. And this is what I mean about, you know, systems and professionals. There's no common sense. I mean, it's like being thrown into a third dimension family court, honest to God.
Yeah.
So I discharged myself from hospital. Now I had to get family members to bring me clothes to the hospital because obviously I'd, you know, gone in with nothing on because it was after the attack. And they turned up with like a fluffy jumper and stuff that I just wouldn't wear to court. I would have wore a suit. Anyway, I was still bruised. And I just actually think when I turned up at court, with this fluffy jumper, bruising on my face. No, we were litigants in person, so neither of us had legal representation. He turned up in a suit, Of course he did. Of course he presents well. You know, I'm standing there looking bruised. And the judge, she looked at me, female judge, and I think she made an assumption, not a judgment.
Did she not know that you'd been in hospital? Did she not know what had happened?
I have no idea. She would have gone off the paperwork that he submitted, and he just submitted just a load of lies saying that I was a drug addict alcoholic, which is absolutely bonkers because I was driving up and down the motorway, going to work, working in technology, working in criminal screening. I mean, the lies that he put on the application, which this is why I think family court is just so ridiculous. How can somebody just off the street put in an application saying absolutely anything they want to and the courts take it seriously? It's a joke.
Did you not submit a statement? Did you not submit a statement for that hearing?
He got an ex parte hearing. So an ex parte hearing means it's an emergency meeting. It's emergency hearing. So, of course, because I was in hospital, wasn't I? I didn't even know this was going on. He had moved so quickly, but it makes me think that he was already trying to do something anyway in the background before this. And probably because of the run-up with the door situation, with Smith smashing the door in, he would have already been doing this in the background. The attack was his moment to swoop in and then take Sophia away.
To be honest.
But actually, Sophia didn't know any life without me. She was a four-year-old little girl.
Yeah. But you see, perpetrators know how perpetrators think.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have been able to preempt, maybe not have preempted the depth, the severity that the lengths that he went to, Jason. But he would have preempted, this is not going to go well. And he would have preempted that there'd been something that he could have, we'll be able to use against you. And that's what he would have been doing. He'd have been sitting and waiting for that moment to come.
Mm.
When he found out about the door being kicked in, he knew, he would have known it would have been, it's going to escalate from there. Because perpetrators know perpetrators. Mm-hmm. They do.
And I think the thing to note is that the father of my 8-year-old son, Cameron, he obviously Cameron was with his dad. He spent those 2 weeks with his dad, of course, you know, and, you know, we didn't tell Cameron he was 8, so he would have understood. So we said that I'd fallen down the stairs. And actually he brought Cameron up to the hospital to see me. You know, he was supportive of me. But actually what Sophia's dad was doing was creating more of an issue. You know, I'm going to take her away. I'm going to punish you for what you've received. It's your fault that you've been violently attacked. But no one thinks about how was I supposed to get this maniac away from me when no one's listening, when he was stalking me, harassing me, turning up, calling. I'm calling the police and saying there's nothing he can do. Even when he smashed the door, they bail him. You are just in a no-win situation as a victim of domestic abuse. And that is what's so abhorrent about it. And that is what the police need to understand and act when a victim reports.
Yeah, because actually you did take steps. When you started to realise, this isn't the right environment for my children to be exposed to, you took steps to secure the children's safety. So that could never be used against you. Nobody can preempt whether they're going to get.
However, it was
no.
However, it you're was. Not.
Yeah. So you took steps. It's not like you stayed in that situation regardless and allowed things to escalate. You didn't. You didn't do that. Mm. So how they could even use that against you?
Mm. And so the judge at that hearing, she said, "Well, Sophia can stay with Dad." And mum gets overnight on a Tuesday and 5 hours on a Saturday. Well, I was like, no, she won't understand what's going on. She already hasn't seen me for 2 weeks. She's 4 years old. And she literally, the judge just got up and walked out the room. I mean, it was just so unprofessional. I've never known anything like it. And at that point, I was like, right, I need a legal team. And I had to instruct a legal team. I mean, I talk more about it in the book. It's really difficult because I can't go into too much detail. We haven't got enough time. But I then instructed a legal team, and that whole process cost me £14,000. And it's horrific, horrific, horrific. And he was just able to put in application after application after application, just about anything. I want her passport because he was trying to take her out of the country. I want this time changed. I want this. I want that. It was just relentless. And it was all just to disrupt my life. Yeah. And so it was very difficult for me at that point to get myself back into work and re-stabilize my position.
No, well, how are you supposed to work when you are you're basically not just recovering, but you're now in another fight for your life, i.e. fighting for your child, getting your child.
So I was literally, I say I've done a law degree because I actually read everything about family law. I had, I found orders that I could use myself. I mean, after I instructed the legal team and we had the final hearing, that wasn't even a final hearing. They call it a final hearing, but he then submitted more applications after that. Yeah. So I then found an order which is called a section 9114, which is a barring order, which I don't like to use. But, I brought that. I then represented myself. This was, a year down the line. And I'd actually submitted that in an application. They didn't grant it. However, they did say to Sophia's dad that if you continue putting in these fictitious applications to court, we could then resurrect this. And that actually was enough to stop him, thankfully. I still have to manage that relationship. Like, I don't have anything to do with him. I've never spoken to him since, and never will, to be honest. He's dead to me after what he's done. But Sophia does have a relationship with the dad, and she sees how he is as a person and is able to manage that herself. Yeah. And she's 15 now, so she's a young woman. But I mean, my story even then, that is the whole family court thing, and that went on over months and months and months, over a year. The story with Jason never ended. We then had witness intimidation. We then had the fact that I was hauled in for questioning. But I know that
we're going to break, and we're going to carry on with this conversation in the next episode, where we're going to unravel all the failings of the police. And believe you and me, I'd love to say this is an isolated case. It's not an isolated case. No. It happens time and time and time again.
Which is why the case is so important.
Which is why it is so important that, Zoe is fighting for this, because it's to make a stand. It's to send a strong message that actually, you can't destroy somebody's life through your own failings and get away with it, because unfortunately that is what happens. So we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Kate's work, head to her bio on UK Health Radio. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and always remember, you're not alone.